This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions in Gaza issued a May Day call. And what they're urging U.S. unions to do is to, quote, go beyond statements and speeches and create real pressure.
The General Federation of Trade Unions of Gaza has called on U.S. workers to launch a general strike on May Day.
The group that organized this demonstration, called the Patriots, is a sovereignist group that is opposed to membership in NATO and the European Union.
The Eurosceptic French Patriot Party resists pouring more billions into the Ukraine war, but Italy is a site of most Western European anti-war protests.
We can be learning from each other, learning from our strengths, if we put more emphasis on unity.
Canadian, U.S., and Mexican trade unionists talk about how they and their countries are being affected by Trump's tariff war.
You know, part of the reason that I think they're able to even think that they can get away with this when it comes to Venezuelans has been the years-long demonization of Venezuela, of the Bolivarian Revolution, of the Maduro government.
Mexican journalist José Luis Granados Ceja explains how Trump is deporting Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador's mega prisons on false premises, with the enthusiastic support of El Salvador's own right-wing president, Nayib Bukele. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The General Federation of Trade Unions of Gaza has called on U.S. workers to launch a general strike on May 1st against the U.S.-supported genocide by Israel in Gaza and for their own struggle against union busting. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer talked with Michael Letwin, who is a member of the UAW and also a founder of Labor for Palestine.
Labor for Palestine began in 2004, so it's over 20 years now. And really, the whole point has been to uphold the call from Palestinian trade unions for solidarity against Zionism. And that includes, of course, support for BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, especially in the labor sphere. And it really builds on and tries to reaffirm the work that began in the late 60s and early 70s in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and the Arab Workers Caucus in the UAW, both of which in Detroit, who brought the issue of Palestine to the UAW. Because the UAW, the Auto Workers Union, for decades, really going all the way back to the Nakba of 1948, has been a major supporter of Zionism, has bought who knows how many millions of Israel bonds. And that really was the issue in 1973, during the 73 war, when Arab workers and Black workers in Detroit went on strike and held protests. In that situation, not against the company, although if they were against the companies, but against the international UAW and the local 600 leadership, which owned Israel bonds and demanded that those Israel bonds be sold. And so you had many Arab workers, in fact, in those plants who were leading that charge, with the support of Black workers, with the support of a lot of white workers and other workers. And so that's what we're trying to build on, is that legacy of anti-Zionism, really anti-labor Zionism, in the workplace, in our unions. And so we formed Labor for Palestine in 2004 to fight to make sure that Palestine was not ignored or sidelined or excluded by the post-9/11 anti-war movement, which many of us were involved with. And also to make sure that we were bringing this fight to labor, within labor, to demand that labor uphold the basic principles of solidarity. An injury to one is an injury to all. We don't cross picket lines, we walk picket lines, and to make that apply just as much to Palestine as anything else. And so, for example, in the UAW, the international continues to own Israel bonds. And we in UAW Labor for Palestine, which is a branch of the National Labor for Palestine National Network, has fought for and demanded since October of 2023 and before for those bonds to be divested. And the international, even under Sean Fain, has refused to do that. So you've got this contradiction between Sean Fain coming out rightly and to his credit in support of the student protesters, you know, the student intifada, the student encampments, demanding disclose, divest, we will not stop, we will not rest when it comes to university investments in Israel, but not applying the same principle to the UAW's own ownership of Israel bonds. So that's what you have on the, you have not only the top-down picture that I'm describing of these unions, which, but also a rank and file approach, which is the Labor for Palestine approach. We've always been about grassroots, rank and file based demands and action. Because with the Palestinian trade union, and this comes to the question of the most recent and you know, Palestinian trade union call, because with the Palestinian trade unions, especially in Gaza, have continually said to us over the decades, but especially since October of 2023, is we appreciate your resolutions, we appreciate your conferences, but words are not enough to stop the genocide. And we're urging you under the bombs if they fall on us. And, you know, who knows how many tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of Palestinian deaths and casualties since October of 23. We are appealing directly to U.S. labor, as they did for their recent May Day statement, to take action, to go beyond words and take action. And that's what Labor for Palestine is trying to do. Not because we have the power as Labor for Palestine on our own to take action in that regard, but rather to organize and urge that kind of action, especially from the rank and file, and to have the rank and file also hold our union leaderships accountable. And that's why groups like UAW, Labor for Palestine, or UE folks in the UE, which has been, you know, one of the most progressive unions, but again, you know, has not put its money necessarily where its mouth is, especially when it comes to endorsing pro-genocidal candidates like Biden in the last election. In SEIU, another one of the ceasefire unions, but we have all these unions, rank and file groups that are affiliated with Live for Palestine National Network, to go beyond and to support the efforts in places like ILWU Local 10 in Oakland, which has refused, for example, to handle Zimline cargo, the Israeli Zimline cargo, for the last 10 years or more, and has kept that cargo more or less from appearing on the West Coast. So that's the approach that we have, and that's what we're trying to answer, are the Palestinian trade union calls for deeds, not just words.
And of course, the increasing attack on UAW members, graduate students, the police raids, the attack even on a lawyer who's representing people who have been attacked. It seems like these fascist attacks, and as combined with the termination of the contract with TSA, the union busting, direct union busting of against workers' rights to organize, the destruction of the NLRB, the destruction of any process. I know the UAW had big plans to organize in the South through the NLRB. I mean, they're not going to be having elections. The attack, the frontal attack on organized labor, you would think that there would be a mass movement and a call in the UAW and other unions to mobilize the entire working class on May Day against these attacks and combine it with the attack on workers around the world.
Right, exactly. And I think what's happened in the UAW to some degree is that you don't hear much at this moment from the international. You know, before the election, you had Sean Fain calling Trump a union buster, and of course supporting Biden and Harris, or, you know, Biden and then Harris. And we in UAW Labor for Palestine called them out on their support for those genocidal candidates. And some of our members were actually dragged out of a political action conference at the UAW in January of 2024, who were heckling Biden for his being a war criminal. And they were dragged out by Secret Service with the applause of many of the delegates at the UAW. So, yes, I mean, but at least before the election, you know, Fain and the leadership was calling out Trump for what he was. And that actually is no longer the case, at least at this moment. The UAW leadership seems to have endorsed Trump's tariff policy, even though that's destroying the economy. It's putting auto workers, unionized auto workers, and many others out of work already, because, of course, that, you know, trade wars are going to do that.
That's what trade wars hurt the working class.
Right. Trade wars hurt the working class, and not only that, but they also have a nasty way of becoming, you know, real wars. I mean, that's part of what led to World War II, right, with trade wars of the 30s. So, you know, you have that, none of that's good for workers. But on top of that, as you point out, the frontal assault on workers, on labor, on immigrants, on everybody, you know, pretty much, except for the billionaire class. And even some of them aren't happy with the tariffs for their own nasty reasons, you know, is really meeting very little organized resistance at this point. And so I think, you know, as you've often pointed out, Steve, and, you know, we certainly agree with in Labor for Palestine, the need to generalize this resistance and to show how these things are connected, to show, for example, how the attack on the Palestine Solidarity Movement and the Gestapo raids that are taking place against immigrants and graduate students and other kinds of workers who are not in universities, of course. They picked up the head of one of the farm worker unions recently and snatched him, and he's now in custody. So, Leila, this kind of thing is one big picture. And of course, the attack on the universities by the administration, the Trump administration, the regime, is being done under the guise of fighting, quote, anti-Semitism, by which they mean opposition to Israeli genocide. So all these things are inextricably connected. There's no way to separate these things. And yet what we're seeing is, one, very little resistance being organized. You know, it was good that there was a hands-off demonstrations on the 5th around the country. And apparently I saw something like 600,000 people reported in D.C., and that's great. But at the same time, the leadership of those demonstrations refused to mention Palestine, refused to make those connections. And that isn't to say that they shouldn't have been supported, the demonstrations, or that it wasn't important to be there. And the people that went and participated, of course, many of them support the Palestine Solidarity Movement, perhaps the overwhelming majority even. But the leaderships there, you know, dominated by the unions, the leaderships of the unions and the Democratic politicians made sure that was not, you know, allowed.
Well, also, they left out military spending. I mean, they're trillions of dollars, and NATO. They supported NATO.
Yes, they supported NATO, right.
And they left out trillions of dollars which are going to the military. In fact, Trump wants to increase the military budget to over $1 trillion now. And that money is coming out of housing, healthcare, education. So to leave that out leaves out what the U.S. capitalists and imperialists are doing, which is let's expand the military and build up the military for war with China and other countries while we're attacking working class here. And the other thing about, you know, Trump and Musk and the fascist, J.D. Vance, is that they actually want to destroy public universities. The attack on NIH, they want to liquidate the public universities as we know them in Project 2025 and privatize them and bust the unions. And they are carrying that out. Isn't that their plan for public universities?
Yeah, I mean, as everybody says, you know, or is often said, Project 2025 tells exactly what they intend to do, and they're doing it. And they're doing it so far with very little resistance. And if we're going to survive this thing, we can't, for example, wait for general strike in 2028, which is what the UAW leadership has been talking about. I mean, it'd be great to have a general strike in 2028, but we need a general strike in 2025 so that we're around in 2028.
If there are unions left in 2028,
yes, exactly. Right. And you know, the UAW, I mean, for example, has already been in decline for decades and decades. I mean, when I first, you know, was aware of the UAW in the late 60s and early 70s, it had over 1 million members. Now it has a few hundred thousand members. Now, you know, a lot of that has to do with deindustrialization, but a lot of it has, you know, to do with the failure of the leadership, not just of that union, but of all the unions, pretty much, to really organize and to defend, you know, their unions, our unions. And, you know, being in bed with the Democrats instead of organizing real resistance. And now more than ever, if we don't organize resistance now, I mean, we're living in, as somebody put it, we're living in a mafia state here. I mean, that's another way of describing what it is, right? It's just a gang, a bunch of gangsters up there, you know, more than ever before, perhaps, in control. And they're doing everything. They're not just attacking public universities. They're attacking private universities. They're not just attacking private universities. They're attacking every single agency of the government that plays a good role, unlike the military, which, of course, they're promoting, and the Gestapo state, essentially, that they're building and that they've unleashed. The snatchings. I mean, it's like Argentina or Chile. Of course, this has happened before in this country. It's not like it's unprecedented. It happened in the Palmer raids, you know, in the late teens of the last century. The first Red Scare. I don't know if it's the first Red Scare. Maybe the first Red Scare was, you know, the Haymarket martyrs. But anyway, you know, they had that, and they had the mass roundup of like 5,000 people were deported during the Palmer raids for being leftists and communists and radicals, socialists, anarchists. And then they did it in the 50s. And now they're using those same laws to do it today. And so, if we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately more than ever before. The Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions in Gaza issued a May Day call on April 4th. And what they're urging U.S. unions to do, and I'm quoting now, is to, quote, go beyond statements and speeches and create real pressure close quote, including, and this is where the quote that you referenced is, general strikes and widespread civil disobedience, close quote, against the ongoing bipartisan U.S.-backed Israeli genocide in Gaza, and to, quote, coordinate efforts with the student movement, close quotes, against the Trump regime's domestic assault on Palestine solidarity. And so they further go on and say, quote, we in the General Federation of Trade Unions in Gaza address this call to you, and they're speaking directly to U.S. labor here. This is addressed to U.S. unions. Back to the statement, on the eve of the International Workers' Day, affirming that your struggle for workers' rights in the United States is inseparable from our struggle against occupation and colonialism. True labor solidarity is demonstrated through actions, not just words. And we count on your awareness and determination to take concrete steps to end this tragedy, meaning the genocide. So, you know, that's the call that we're hearing from Palestine. Even if there was no genocide in Gaza, even if there was no Palestine, we would have to be resisting this Trump regime. But there is, on top of everything else, of course, and at the forefront and the foremost, the genocide in Gaza. And we're being called upon, you know, urged by people directly under that boot of U.S. weaponry being, you know, deployed to demolish and destroy, you know, the lives of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Palestinians.
Journalists and only workers, I mean, you know, they're decimating the whole society.
Right. Health workers, they massacred, they executed 16 health workers, you know, a week ago, not to mention the journalists, not to mention everybody in between, not to mention the fact that there are more child amputees in Gaza than anywhere in the world. Not to mention that just 2 days ago, or was it yesterday, they bombed another house in Gaza and killed six more children and all kinds of other people. So, I mean, it's unbearable, of course. It's particularly unbearable for the people that are directly under that. It's even unbearable to know of it. But to not be responding, you know, the way the unions do not respond, to not even reference this call from Palestine, let alone respond to it and take the kind of action that we need and that they need and that we need together. That's what solidarity is all about. It's not simply do-goodism or, you know, or morality, although those are good things. But it's the idea that all of our fate as workers and as oppressed people are tied together inextricably, as the Palestinian Trade Union statement says. And that if we don't act together, you know, we are all of us doomed. And yet there's virtually no response, even from the unions, even from the unions that came out for ceasefire and arms embargo, they have not responded to or even referenced this call. So again, Labor for Palestine is not, you know, does not have major resources. It doesn't have anything like that. But we do have our voice, and we are doing our best to uplift these calls and to bring these issues to our unions and to our workplaces and to see if on May Day and the events leading up to May Day and beyond May Day, if real action can be taken, including wherever possible, withholding of labor. And it remains to be seen where that can be done. But even for places that it can't be done, there are all kinds of actions that can be taken to show solidarity with Palestine at the workplace, in our unions. And we need to be doing that. We need to be doing that for ourselves, for them, above all, and for ourselves. Because, you know, as the slogan goes, Palestine will free us all. What that really refers to is that throwing off the yoke of oppression and genocide is liberating for everybody. And we need to be doing our best to support that.
That was Michael Letwin, UAW member and founder of Labor for Palestine, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Which side are you on? 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 This corporation giant gets rich from weapon sales. Countries turn to chaos as constant war prevails. Which side are you on? 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 Raytheon helps Israel to cause a genocide. It isn't complicated for me to take a side. Let me hear you. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? One more time. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. European leaders promised billions in military aid to Ukraine with limited resistance outside Italy. Pacifica's Anne Garrison spoke to Paris-based journalist and author Diana Johnstone.
The Ukraine war grinds on, despite Donald Trump's campaign promise to end it in a day. Ukraine expanded conscription age from 25 to 60 years old, while many Ukrainian men continue to flee the country or go into hiding to avoid it. European leaders recently gathered in Paris, where they announced their plan to reinforce support for Ukraine. France announced a 2.2 billion euro military aid package, and there was also talk of sending French or other European soldiers. The only group to object in France was the Eurosceptic French Patriot Party, which opposes French membership in both NATO and the European Union. Patriot Party leader Florian Philippot led a march through the streets of Paris to protest the military aid package and the possibility of sending French soldiers. Neither French nor international media covered the march at all, but several YouTube channels shared footage of it and reported it to be roughly 5,000 people. I spoke to author, journalist, and Consortium News contributor Diana Johnstone, who lives in Paris. Diana, what is the message of those resisting French involvement in the Ukraine war?
The group that organized this demonstration, called the Patriots, is a sovereignist group that is opposed to membership in NATO and the European Union, that they would like to have an independent France. It's a sort of a Gaullist position. And they don't want to spend more money on Ukraine. They don't want to pursue that. And that's their message.
Yeah, I think they said France is deeply in debt and has no business giving.
Well, it is. I mean, of course, it is deeply in debt. All of Europe can't afford all this big spending that the European Union has decided. Ursula von der Leyen, who has taken over control of Europe without any justification, has decided that Europe is going to spend all this money supporting Ukraine. But as I say, there is no media coverage of this demonstration. The objection to this policy is invisible as far as the media is concerned.
How widespread is the resistance? Does it go beyond the Patriot Party?
Well, you don't know, because certainly among parties, no. You don't know because if you don't have an organized something or other, you don't know what people think. So this is not a huge movement. This was, they said something like 5,000 or more. That's not very much for Paris. It was a very vigorous type of demonstration, but if it's 5,000, that's not huge. And I don't know, because the fact is the public seems very passive in all this in France, remarkably passive. If you want to see anti-war demonstrations, go to Italy. There are a whole bunch of them this weekend, starting in Rome and other major cities. Italy is where you have constant big anti-war demonstrations. That's the country that's most, if you don't count the countries such as Hungary and Slovakia, who are opposed to this war policy. But if you stay in the big Central European countries, Italy is where you have the most popular protests.
That was Paris-based author and journalist Diana Johnstone on the Eurosceptic French Patriot Party's resistance to further French involvement in the Ukraine war. The French left, she also said, is now primarily identitarian and not anti-war. In Italy, on April 7th, tens of thousands marched through the streets of Rome to protest the European Union's rearmament plans.
Swallow you, lay your body. cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body.
That was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Find the Cost of Freedom. Canadian, U.S., and Mexican workers are now being pitted against each other in the trade war escalated by the Trump government. At a panel sponsored by Workweek, Canadian, U.S., and Mexican trade unionists talked about how they and their countries are being affected by the trade war.
Everybody, I think that really what is critical is to have unity amongst workers who are in the same industry, battling the same corporations, and to do it in a way that to raise demands that confronts the corporate control of the industry and of our countries. The problem with tariffs is that, first of all, it leads to a tariff war, and in these days, tariff wars are increasingly dangerous of developing into other sorts of wars. And it also, it creates the idea that it's workers fighting against each other over the jobs. And from the point of view of an auto worker in Canada, for example, because of the integration of our industry, over 90% of the vehicles that are assembled in Canada are exported, almost all of them, to the United States. We're not building vehicles for our own market. I think that's not quite the same in Mexico, but it's similar in that a lot of the production in Mexico is for export to the United States. So as soon as you say tariff, you're saying take those jobs out of Mexico and out of Canada and moving them to the U.S. And so I think that we need demands that lead us in the direction of workers having more power and more control, and the working class being able to reconstruct our economies and our country so that our interests come to the fore. So, for example, public ownership in transportation and manufacturing, to take power away from the corporations and to ensure that decisions are being made in the interests of our communities and in the interests of workers. It's also, I think, indicative of the lack of working class consciousness amongst much of the leadership of our unions in Canada and the United States, that there is such a negative view of Mexico, Mexican workers, and Mexican unions. And a complete lack of recognition of the positive steps that have been made under the government of AMLO and now Claudia Sheinbaum, doubling the minimum wage in Mexico over the last 4 years, much better labor legislation overall in Mexico than in either the United States or Canada. We can be learning from each other, learning from our strengths, if we put more emphasis on unity. And absolutely that means that workers in the United States and Canada and Mexico should be meeting and talking to each other so that we can develop a common program.
And I think one of the things we want to emphasize in that is that jobs, we can't depend on the ruling class or the corporations to protect our jobs. Those jobs are our jobs. They're our property. We have created the wealth, and we have a right to those jobs, to our jobs. And we need to re-raise demands for short work week. In the UAW, we had a guaranteed jobs bank. We had guaranteed jobs that were ones who struggle that were actually in effect until they were sold out in the bankruptcy in 2008. So I think we need to raise that idea too, that the defense of our jobs is done through the strength of our union, demanding that our jobs are our right and that they're guaranteed, and through short work week, guaranteed jobs, revival of the jobs banks, demand that ensure the jobs on all fronts. And I just want to make one other point. One thing I think is that we shouldn't despair about the prospects for the period to come. I remember in 81 when Reagan got elected on a program that wasn't a whole lot different than Trump's, it led to Solidarity Day through an AFL-CIO leadership that was actually even worse than the current leadership being compelled to call the biggest labor march that I've ever seen in my 55 years of activism of 500,000 workers. And I remember at that moment, the buses that I organized for my local, every worker was ready for a general strike. Unfortunately, the union leadership didn't take it that far, but the mood through struggle, that mood, there was a mood that was created and that compelled even the worst leadership to take action. And the last point I would make, I feel an optimism that we're going to move, that the labor movement with all its contradictions is going to be pushed into that direction. And in being pushed, being forced to unify with all those who are already fighting, LGBTQ people fighting, because they've been previously eliminated. The fight against racism, which is so grotesque right now. Immigrant rights. It's interesting to me that as bad as Fain's statement was on tariffs, yesterday he issued a very good statement on defending the federal workers. And he invoked PATCO. He said, the actions the administration has taken today are many times worse than PATCO, affecting over 1 million federal employees. We have learned from the past and won't sit back quietly while unions are dismantled. The labor movement is not about party politics. We're not Democrats or Republicans. We're trade unionists. And when you come after workers, you're going to find us standing shoulder to shoulder, ready to fight back. Having been active in the UAW for many years, when I see Fain, I see a leader who on one hand embraces class struggle, but without an ideological basis. He's not ideologically rooted. So he shifts from left to right. You know, we saw it in the election. But we shouldn't write off even someone like him. I think the whip of reaction is going to push many leaders who we look at pretty warily now to be forced into a stand. I think we need to encourage that. Workers sometimes learn more through action than they do through all the manifestos we can put out. And I think we're in a period that's going to compel that action. And I think we should encourage it and find a way. The ILWU gave the model many years ago with the Million Worker March. I always felt that it was a shame they did it in an election year. But the Million Worker March is just what's needed now, a march of all workers, not just union workers, but workers, immigrant workers, unemployed workers, people losing their food stamps. Oh, that's our class, of our entire class. LGBTQ, let's not remember, they've written off transgender people like they don't exist. That's part of our class too. And if we can find a way to encourage a mobilization and bring and have labor spearhead that mobilization, I think we'll see a big, it'll open up the door ideologically as well, because action sometimes precedes ideology in terms of the consciousness. It opens up the consciousness of the workers. So let's have optimism and push it forward.
Von Palmer, and he's vice president at large for the Teamsters.
There has been sort of this business unionism approach to handling the situation where the leadership of the Teamsters, primarily the general president, has decided that it's easier to play go along and get along with the Trump administration and some of the political hacks that are a part of this administration. So I've been very vocal about the effects this was going to have on our membership. Because obviously, a large portion of what we do is transportation. Of course, very varied membership. We have a lot of farm workers and people that are involved with not necessarily farm work, but produce, canning, and meat production. So the impact of this, we have Canadian Teamsters, and the president of Teamsters Canada was very outspoken in a statement about the impact it was going to have on members, our members, Teamster members on both sides of the border, and the trade that had been, you know, our most valuable trade partners are Canada and Mexico. So the impact upon, you know, like the auto industry in particular, where we transport parts and, you know, all kinds of stuff to the auto manufacturers is going to be impactful. Our silence around all this has been deafening, and so I've been very outspoken about it. I think now is not a time for anybody in this country in particular to think that this is going to go away in the next election cycle or by simply playing along, go along, get along. Our stock market is already in a downfall. It's down more than 10%. So the impacts are going to be great. Sitting on your hands is not an option.
The first thing that I'd like to say is that the among our friends, thank you for the invitation, is that the announcement of this tariffs against by the government of Donald Trump has generated a lot of uncertainty and a lot of among the Mexican working class, especially within the sectors of the maquillador sector. So also Mexico exports 80% of its products to the U.S. and in fact this caused a lot of nervousness because there's an estimated loss of 700,000 jobs immediately, specifically in the steel industry and the auto parts industries. So one thing to keep in mind regarding the unions in the northern part, specifically in this area, those industries, is that they're not democratic unions. They're business unions and they're controlled by big business as well as by politicians. And we all know that one of the reasons why a lot of these industries from the U.S. moved to Mexico in the first place in the 80s was because the salaries are so low and the working conditions are so bad. So the fact that these unions are not democratic are one of the main obstacles to why, you know, it's harder to fight this.
I'm part of UAW, and here in our union, we are seeing how our own president, which is Sean Fain, has decided in a way that is short-sighted to ally itself with Trump in the question of tariffs, assuming that indeed these tariffs will actually make these manufacturing companies bring all their equipment to the US and increase the number of jobs here, without understanding that companies won't seek in the US jobs that are protected by unions. They will want to hire people in the same conditions as they hire them in Mexico, which are very marginalized conditions. No, so we have this this problem with Sean Fain, and there's this division in our union because there are some workers that actually have deluded themselves into thinking that these jobs that are going to be created in the U.S. are going to be jobs that are again going to be protected by the unions and are going to pay well. And that division is actually also being shown in UAWD. So there's a lot of problems here, and there's no easy solution besides actually trying to create these links between the international working class. I don't think there's any other way of solving this.
Those were the voices of Canadian, US, and Mexican workers discussing the effect of the trade war on them and their fellow workers. That was Las Cafeteras, La Bamba Rebelde. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Next, speaking to host Katie Halper, Mexican journalist José Luis Granados Ceja explained how Trump is deporting Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador's mega prisons on false premises, with the enthusiastic cooperation of El Salvador's own right-wing president, Nayib Bukele.
We can start with Venezuela because, you know, it's interesting. At the beginning, it looked like there might have been kind of a diplomatic détente, right, where the special envoy, Grenell, goes and visits the first official actual visit to Miraflores, the presidential palace in Caracas. You know, they reach this agreement. Grenell takes some of the U.S. citizens back with him. They agree that to receive some of these deportation flights. And it seemed like things were going in the right direction. But then the hardliners in Trump's coalition won. And so the Rubios, the Maria Elvira Salazars, all of these who wanted a hardline position against the government in Venezuela. And so then we saw basically a return to the maximum pressure strategy of Trump's first term, which Biden largely kept in place. I would say the only thing that Biden changed was this Chevron license, which Trump has now rescinded, ordering them to wind down operations. And so we're back to the maximum pressure strategy. Grenell, in an interview with the Epoch Times, said, no, Trump doesn't want regime change, but he's doing everything last time that he was implementing in order to achieve regime change in Venezuela. And so obviously Venezuela, because of the strained diplomatic relationship, said we're not going to receive direct deportation flights from the US anymore. One of the ways that Trump has kind of worked around this is securing a deal with Bukele, who seems intent on turning his country into the prison, the slave house of Latin America. And I use those kind of really strong language deliberately. He's built these mega prisons in his country, and they're meant to kind of respond to his own security strategy, which has been very popular, admittedly so, inside of El Salvador, but basically violating any kind of due process, human rights, civil rights that did exist, jailing anybody and everybody that is suspected of having any ties to organized crime or gangs, as they call them, in El Salvador, and now opening it up to basically renting it out so that people can be, who are being deported from the U.S. can now be jailed there. And that's precisely what happened. So the first group that got sent there, apparently in violation of a judicial injunction, were sent on a plane to El Salvador with a lot of fanfare. They released all kinds of really gross propaganda videos, just really denigrating human beings, you know, shaving them on camera. And there's reports also of kind of striking them and insulting them and all the rest of it. So basically the treatment that they've been applying to Salvadorans who have been detained to these migrants, all based on this accusation that their ties to a gang that was born in Venezuela, but really kind of grew in terms of its influence inside of the United States, called Tren de Aragua. Now, the curious thing is that it turns out many of the people were identified by their tattoos or their shoes or just by their faces, by relatives who assure that they are not tied to organized crime or gangs at all. In fact, there was another plane. So now, because the U.S. doesn't send planes directly to Venezuela, what's been happening is they send them either to Mexico, and then from Mexico they go to Venezuela. This last one came from Honduras. It's actually the second flight, if I'm not mistaken, coming from Honduras. And the interior minister of Venezuela, Diosdado Cabello, said none of them have any ties to Tren de Aragua. So it's just an effort to criminalize all migrants, to criminalize all Venezuelans in particular. And it's really tragic, ironic in a sense, because in the actual text of the invocation of the Alien Enemies Act, he says that Venezuela deliberately sent them into the United States to sow unrest and all the rest of it. Also even accusing Maduro of being the Cartel de Soles, just this fantasy that they have. But if you look at a recent report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, they figured out, they pointed out that in cases of Cuba, Venezuela, what drives migration? Unilateral course of measures, sanctions, the oil blockade of Venezuela, the blockade of Cuba. They're not being sent there. They are fleeing their countries that are undergoing hardship as a result of US foreign policy. And now to turn that around and to say that they're actually being sent deliberately, it's so grotesque. And then to take them and throw them into a prison like this when many of them didn't have due process. I mean, just recently, I think it was yesterday, came out, the judge wants to know if his order was violated, which he has the right to do. That's what the judicial branch of government is meant to do. It'd be a check on the executive. They're now calling it a state secret. So first, all the fanfare, publishing videos everywhere, photos, celebrating. Oh, now it's a state secret. Now we can't say, because it might violate. It's absolutely patently absurd. And it's all part of this agenda. It's a racist, xenophobic agenda to really tar all migrants. And one final note on this, because it's really quite tragic as well. So something around 550,000 Haitians, Cubans, Venezuelans, they accepted what's called the parole program in the U.S. So it's not like parole in prisons. It's just the term they use. So basically, if they had a sponsorship, a community, a family member who was willing to take them in, they would have a 2-year permission to be inside of the United States while they looked for other kinds of either asylum or permanent residency or another work visa, whatever it was. Those have been rescinded, and they've been told to leave by, sometime in April. I thought Trump said he was only going to kick out the criminal elements, right? But because of this effort to try all Venezuelans, to Tren de Aragua, you know, people are believing this. Like, oh no, they're all illegals, they're all criminals, they all should go. Some of the people who were sent to El Salvador presented themselves at their CBP-1 appointments, and now they're in languishing in a prison in Central America, which has a lot about Bukele as well in terms of the lengths he's willing to go to appease Trump. He obviously really wants to be in favor with him because he's got his own authoritarian regime that he's trying to cultivate there, you know, obviously perpetuating himself in power despite the fact that El Salvador doesn't permit re-election, but yet there he is.
People are saying, oh, this is great. Bukele is really helping make El Salvador a safer place. What's your response to that?
I mean, his policies have certainly impacted the level of crime that's happening inside of El Salvador. And it explains why he is so popular. But of course, it's something that is effective in a country like El Salvador. It's a very, very small country. It's one of the smallest countries in the world with a very limited population. You know, in fact, here in Mexico, there was a debate happening where he criticized Mexico in its security policy with a really kind of absurd argument. He basically said, he's like, Mexico is made up of you know, states just the way that the United States is. And he's like, something like 29 of them actually have a smaller population than El Salvador. Why don't they just do state by state and reduce crime that way, the way that we've done it? In a territory like Mexico, organized crime groups don't respect state boundaries, and that strategy would not work. But even if we were to apply it, we're talking about jailing millions upon millions of Mexicans in equivalent in terms of population for that to work. It only works there because of the small population can actually conceivably jail enough people to actually bring crime down. But there's no attention to the root causes. Right. There's no concern about the future of young people. What are the economic prospects for a country like El Salvador with the reputation that it is now earning throughout the world? What's going to happen when, you know, the kids who are 14, 15, 16 years old grow up and there's no jobs for them? Is that the future that waits for them? Just another, you know, bunk in one of these mega prisons that he's building? And it's actually an economic policy for him, too, because he's charging the U.S. to house these migrants. You know, they asked Rubio, well, you know, we've heard reports that a lot of the people who have been sent have no criminal records whatsoever. He's like, well, if it turns out they don't, El Salvador can just deport them to Venezuela then, right? Like, just, you know, we're going to wash our hands of it. I've been reading this analyst, Aaron Melchick, I think is his name. I apologize. But he's been really driving this point home, which is just like, there is no law anywhere in the U.S. books that allows them to do what they did to these Venezuelan migrants to send them to El Salvador. There's no actual way to justify it. And yet they do it. Just yesterday, now they want, because they're not allowed to deport or expel people according to this order by a federal judge, now they're extraditing them as a way of working around it. So it shows just how aggressive they are. They'll do anything to continue with this policy. That's a really important alarm bell to sound, because if they do it to them, they'll do it to everybody. That's the point, right? Like, they want to see how far they can get. And then that part means maybe they'll start, or as they already have, going after green card holders. There's even talk about them sending U.S. citizens to El Salvador. If they can get away with it, they will do it.
How do Trump's policies compare to Biden's?
You know, part of the reason that I think they're able to even think that they can get away with this when it comes to Venezuelans has been the years-long demonization of Venezuela, of the Bolivarian Revolution, of the Maduro government. You know, that it's so easy to throw these terms around, the regime and the dictatorship and the rest of it. And so therefore, all the Venezuelans, you know, people find it maybe believable to when they hear that Maduro's emptying out his jails to send them over to the United States. And it's all because of this campaign, which the Democrats also, you know, participated in, right? Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been one of the loudest voices, a Democrat from Florida, around the so-called dictatorship and the human rights violations that are allegedly happening in Venezuela. And that's part of it, right? I think that's part of the kind of bipartisan consensus when it comes to Venezuela. And so to answer your question, I think that the change has been virtually none, right? Things are certainly more aggressive. I think, for example, what happened very recently over the weekend, this announcement that Trump is going to apply this term he invented, secondary tariffs, to all countries who are buying oil and gas from Venezuela. Oddly enough, you know, one of the countries that's buying oil and gas from Venezuela? It's the United States. So I guess other countries are going to get sanctioned. It doesn't even make any sense. If you look at some Venezuelan economists like Francisco Rodriguez, for example, he's always like, it doesn't make sense. So Repsol is a Spanish company that is involved in the Venezuelan oil industry. Are we now going to apply 25% tariffs against the country of Spain, against that enterprise, against individual members of the Spanish government? Or like, it doesn't even, it's incoherent. And in fact, the text of his actual thing also delegates the decision-making to Marco Rubio. So now a Secretary of State's going to decide who gets tariffed? when tariffs are actually a congressional decision, the only reason that he's able to even pretend to apply these kinds of taxes on imports is because of the emergency declaration. So the whole thing is really quite confused. It's just kind of, in a lot of ways, it's the same. Certainly when it comes to policy like Venezuela, it's aimed at the same thing, regime change. It's about demonizing. It's about making an example of a country that has, you know, asserted its sovereignty. And then I think, there are degrees to this. And who's going to pay the price in the case of Venezuela? Well, it's going to be Venezuelans, right? It's already, you know, a challenging economic situation in that country. There's been some moderate improvements, of course. They've kind of had to remake their economy and reorient, you know, how they actually have structured. They were largely dependent on oil exports, less so now. But, you know, this is going to have a consequence, and it's going to be very difficult for them. Who else pays the price? You know, migrants, of not just Venezuelans, but Mexicans, Guatemalans, Central Americans, Haitians. So it's, you know, it's, I fear that it's just the beginning of a long series of really increasingly worse policies. But I don't want to absolve the Democrats of it, because, you know, they're in a lot of ways responsible for putting us into this position of really allowing the discussion, the debate, to shift so far to the right because of their policy failures and their regime change efforts. Let's look at Cuba, just to talk about a different country. And on his last days, he lifted this designation of state sponsor of terrorism on Cuba. It was meaningless at that point. Cuba could have made up for lost ground if that had been done at the beginning of his term. And so, of course, Trump comes in and immediately reverses it. So it meant nothing. And it was almost like an insult that he did it. And so Democrats, in some ways, are responsible for the crisis that Cubans are now living under, right? And why they feel compelled to migrate to different countries in order to be able to survive. It's U.S. foreign policy at the end of the day, which doesn't really vary that much between parties, that is leading to this circumstance. And so I guess that means that we have to increase our anti-imperialist consciousness. You know, I've been watching some of these mobilizations happening in the United States, these rallies that Bernie and AOC are doing. And it just kind of, I hate to be cynical about it, because, you know, at least people are doing more than voting. But, you know, it just feels like the same, you know, the meme of like the Charlie Brown kicking the football. Like, they're just going to channel people back into the Democratic Party so that they can do the show all over again. And maybe in 4, 8, or 8 years, they win again and just kind of do more of the same, but with like a more friendly veneer. That's right. Got to be having exhausted at this point, right? And so I always want to put emphasis on the U.S. population. I still have faith in you, U.S. people, right? To see what's happening. I'm hearing a lot of noise, for example, around these May Day mobilizations around migration and things like that. You know, we saw these huge ones in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, just like millions of people taking to the streets. I hope that's kind of the direction where people are going, independent, grassroots, anti-imperialist, you know, pro-migrant mobilizing, because I think that's what's going to be able to save us. Obviously, we had a long discussion around the justice system basically not being able to hold the executive to an account. They're openly flaunting. They are attacking judges on national television. So that means it's up to us as the population to be able to actually resist this, because the institutions apparently are not up to the task. I always try not to tell anybody in the U.S. what to do, but I do encourage them to see the experience of Mexico. We had a very firmly entrenched duopoly in this country. Yeah. The whole 21st century was basically ruled by two parties, PAN and the PRI, right? And then before that, a 70-plus year dictatorship. And it was very violent. People were martyred as a result of their efforts to build an alternative electoral force. And then that electoral force became so corrupted and so consumed by the system that we had to go and create another electoral body, an electoral organ, Morena, to be able to once again contend and actually put a left-wing option on the ballot. It was difficult, but we got there. And, you know, we had at one moment, we were talking about how Claudia Sheinbaum was able to kind of buck this trend. You know, not only did she win, but she actually exceeded the level of vote and support that López Obrador did in 2018 when she won in 2024. So I think there's important lessons there. Obviously, there's a lot of things that you have to adapt to your reality. But I do think that there is something there for people to take away, to learn that it wasn't easy, but it was definitely worth it.
That was Mexican journalist José Luis Granado Ceja speaking on the Katie Halper Show. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Anne Garrison, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.